Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral arguments from petitioners in APS Investors versus McLaughlin.
May it please the court. Mr. Cutler and Mr. Comet will present arguments for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Cutler will open with the first 11 minutes. Mr. Cutler will also present the rebuttal.
If it pleases the court, this is a contractual interference case, and the court is faced with two questions. The first one is whether a plaintiff can recover damages in the contractual interference case when the contract itself is not only unenforceable, but as a matter of law could not have been performed even long before the obligation was due. The answer is no, because one, it's not interference, and two, there can be, as a matter of law, no proximate cause of the plaintiff's damages. The second question is whether a plaintiff can recover damages for contractual interference when the, even under the plaintiff's theory of the case, the defendant at the very most induced the obligor under the contract to follow the contract. We feel the answer to this is also no, because as a matter of law, that would not be any interference. Let me first turn to the proximate cause issue. In this case, the contract could not be performed by its terms as a matter of law for these reasons. The obligor under the contract was insolvent, declared to be insolvent by the federal government, faced in receivership, and in fact, this contract on which there is suit for contractual interference was repudiated by the federal government, again, long before the performance the plaintiff complains of was due. As a result, there can be no proximate cause of any damages.
Well, now, you're taking the performance as just a one-shot, one-time event. I mean, what if multiple aspects to it?
Yes, sir, it did, but the only damage the plaintiff sued for and asked the jury for was the value of the purchase option in this case. And the purchase option was not performable until 91, and the obligor was taken down and this contract was repudiated in 89. And that's why we reached the conclusion that it is long before. In the past arguments, the court asked, I think, a very important question, and that is Withers versus Clemens correctly decided? Let me answer that differently than I think the others did. I think it is not. On its narrow holding, it may be right. But is a broad premise that an unenforceable contract is not, or is subject to contractual interference and you can have damages for it, that holding is wrong. Now, if you think about Withers versus Clemens, it was a real estate commission case that was discussed in pretty good detail for you, but what happened there is Justice Reedley, in writing that opinion, noted something very important. And that was there was no indication that the obligor under the contract intended to repudiate it at any time or not to perform. And in fact, Justice Reedley says that one of the things that is important was that the interferer, the defendant in that case, was the one who induced the non-performance. And he reasoned, and I think correctly through from previous decisions, that a mere enforceability issue didn't mean that someone could interfere. The issue of proximate cause was not before the court in that case, interestingly, and is not discussed, and that is a specific difference.
Let me ask you, what you said in that decision was the court was, I think, moved by the fact that it perceived at least that that was the majority view across the United States at the time. Has there been any movement in the case law in other states or the commentators away from that position? That you can interfere with an unenforceable contract?
Your Honor, I think the courts draw this distinction. If a contract is unenforceable, and by that it is meant that it is merely voidable, and that is, in other words, that the obligor could perform if the obligor wished to, and there was nothing to stop the obligor from performing, and I think this is very crucial, the obligor before the interference didn't indicate that he, she, or it was not going to perform because of the voidability, then I think the law is almost identical to what Justice Reedley said it is. On the other hand, if there's some indication or some other reason that it was impossible to perform, I think the court is governed by the logic of this court in Jewler Fowler Holmes. And if you'll recall, several years later, 1990, this court was faced with that case in which the court found that that contract was void and also unenforceable, and this court reaches the almost exact opposite conclusion. And what the court said there was that if it was void as a matter of law, you can't interfere with that. What the court also seems to hold is that one of the reasons for that is there can be no proximate cause damages if it couldn't be performed. Applying those two cases to our case, I think you see that we're much closer to Juliet Fowler Holmes.
But their argument is that their actions made it non-performable before the federal government ever stepped in.
Yes, Your Honor.
The interference actually occurred well before the bank was in jeopardy.
Let me confess to you that it is true that the acts they claim that are interference, that as you know in our other points of error, we claim are not, because we claim we followed the contract, happened before the time of interference. No doubt about that. They also say in their brief, interestingly, that we caused the reason that this contract was repudiated. There is no evidence of that in this record at all.
However, you caused the agreement to be unenforceable. If the third party causes the agreement to be unenforceable.
Yes, sir.
By saying to First Texas, here, let's fix these folks and transfer this away so there's no way of performing. Why isn't that interference?
Your Honor, that is a closer case, and you're exactly right. If you have another event that occurs that does that, it would take this, I think, take us out of the Juliet Fowler Holmes scenario. No doubt about that.
Did ACS own more than GSD? Did it own more than...
No, sir.
It only owned the assets at First Texas?
Oh, I misunderstood your question. Did it own other assets and other businesses,
yes.
ACS and in and of itself?
Yes.
Yes, it did, and let me explain that, because I think that's unclear from both the briefs after I've had an opportunity to read them in preparation for this argument. The transaction, and I hope I'm answering your question, I think I understand it. The transaction here, what ACS obtained, was the entire data servicing of First Texas. Even the government services part of that was a minuscule, almost minute part of that. Going even further and one step further, the business that was sold by the plaintiffs was a small share of the government services. So there was a lot of things transferred that had nothing to do with the plaintiff's cause of action.
So First Texas retained 51%,
yes, sir,
of ACS, but your argument is it could not satisfy its obligation by simply transferring some of that stock to McLaughlin because ACS owned more than the GSD services that McLaughlin was after.
Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand your question, but if you were asking me is the reason that ACS wouldn't perform or couldn't perform, is that your question?
The reason that First Texas couldn't perform is that the stock that it owned in ACS represented more than ownership of the asset that McLaughlin claimed.
That is one truth, but also it is our position, as you know from the brief, that First Texas could very well have performed under the option. And in fact, if you look at paragraph 2 of the McLaughlin agreement, you'll see two things. First off, there is a provision that there is an accounting mechanism to take care of this asset. Remember, this asset was basically a concept and a theory and six contracts that may have future revenue. And I want to emphasize, may have future revenue. So as a result of that, there's no doubt that you could perform under the option because the option was a calculation of money. That calculation of money is in paragraph 3 of the document. And in fact, that is further supported, Your Honor, because the early buyout of the option, which is the right First Texas had, was purely an opportunity to pay money. And that is under both Sections 5 and Sections 10. So there was no doubt that First Texas could have performed. Interestingly, we disagree on one factual matter, and I hate to bring up factual matters when our points are legal, but basically what the plaintiffs claim is The PNC agreement, which was the sale agreement between First Texas and ACS, has in it some acknowledgement of conflicting rights between the two. If you will look at paragraph 7.1, which is cited and quoted in the bodies of both parties' briefs and also in the appendix, you'll see that that's not so. What happened was there is an acknowledgement of certain rights in the McLaughlin Agreement. There is a suggestion that that First Texas has to fulfill those rights. It has the obligation to do it, which is exactly what First Texas did have the obligation to do. And second, and very important, it also provided and contemplated that money would be paid by the plaintiffs, and the terms compensation and payments are used. Now, in fact, we know that eventually it could not perform. But nonetheless, there was no doubt that the option would carry on in that regard.
Mr. Keller, you make the distinction, I think, between circumstances where a defendant causes an agreement to be unenforceable and one where through factors beyond its control it becomes enforceable. Are you making that distinction?
Yes, I am making that distinction, Your Honor, in two ways. First off, there's no evidence that any of the actions we did caused this to be unenforceable but for one piece of testimony, and it is from the plaintiff himself, who says that the government would have not repudiated and taken this contract had, and that is speculation that the Dallas Boys Club and several other sports decisions would not support Crockett.
Hypothetically, if the defendant was exercising its legal rights, even in ultimately doing some act that caused or contributed to causing the contract to be unenforceable, are you saying that that still is grounds for a tortious interference?
No, it is not. If you induce the obligor to do what the obligor had the right to do, as a definition, it can't be interference.
And how does the opposing party protect itself from those circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, there is no need for protection if the contract is being performed as the parties intended it to be performed.
You make some arguments about Section 10B of the letter agreement.
Yes, sir.
When were those presented to the trial court?
Yes.
Can you just give me the record sites or
Your Honor,
generally where they showed up?
Oh, in the statement of facts.
Well, how did you write it? Can you just briefly tell me how you raised Section 10B and your arguments under 10B?
We raised them in the trial court.
Trial court and CA.
Your Honor, they were introduced, they were discussed during the argument, they were discussed in the post-trial motions, and they were also discussed, of course, in the Court of Appeals. And I'm afraid I can't be more specific.
Because they made the argument that was waived, that was never presented before.
Oh, the 10B argument?
Yeah.
Your Honor, they make that in connection with something else. They make that in connection with our argument that the 10B has an impact on the court's decision that you couldn't sever the purchase obligation from the asset itself. That didn't become an issue to the Court of Appeals based its decision on that. That was never a theory that the plaintiff really advocated, and the Court of Appeals opinion included that. We complained on motion for rehearing of that, and then we brought it to this court based on that presentation. I'm going to let Mr. Conant, if you don't mind, complete the argument.
Police Board Counsel, I'm Al Conant. I'm representing Mr. Livingston Cosburg. McLaughlin made no effort in the court at all to fulfill the heavy burden that he had under this court's opinion in Maxey, as refined subsequently by the Holloway case. When they belatedly grasped that fact on appeal, their only response to that was to cite to the court fragments of the transaction, pick out bits and pieces of the transaction, and invite the court to exercise not its legal acumen, but business judgment. And that, in fact, is what the Court of Appeals did. It said simply, this transaction may have made sense had the corporation been solvent. It did not make sense for an insolvent corporation. And the question becomes, oh, really? Where is that in the evidence? Because not a single witness testified in this case that the ACS transaction was in any way detrimental to First Texas. In fact, all of the uncontroverted evidence is directly opposed to that. And if the court
sees that... The CA bought that argument.
Pardon?
The CA bought that argument.
The CA apparently bought that argument. Bought the argument that they could somehow look at the transaction untutored by due diligence, analysis of the P&L, analysis of the balance sheet, or knowledge of the business and the past history of the business in the hands of First Texas, and conclude that it made no sense from an insolvency standpoint. And we respectfully submit that the court can't take that business judgment away from the eight directors, not just Mr. Cosberg, but the eight directors of First Texas who believed that this was in the best interest of this corporation. May I have just about one more minute or 30 seconds?
You can have one more minute. Well, add 1 minute to the respondent's side as well.
If for any reason the court wants to question Mr. Cosberg's own testimony concerning the advantages, the many advantages of this transaction to First Texas, then the court need only consider the testimony of Mr. Biederman. Mr. Biederman was a man who had come to First Texas after a distinguished career as a businessman, savings and loan regulator. He came because he believed, because the government had led him to believe, that First Texas was going to be a survivor under the Southwest plan. Mr. Biederman is now the dean of the School of Business at the University of Delaware. Mr. Biederman, for reasons personal to himself, did not accept the options that were offered as a part of the ACS deal, even though he says that the lawyers all advised him that there was nothing wrong with it. What did he say about this deal?
Counsel,
it was a good deal.
Time's
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions?
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Tumlin will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, good morning. I'm Joe Chumley, together with John Phelan. We've represented Tom McLaughlin and John Lazovich from throughout this lawsuit and the appeals. Tom McLaughlin and John Lazovich owned option rights and other contract rights under the McLaughlin Agreement that were neither unenforceable, void, nor terminable. They were subject to First Texas's opportunity to purchase them for $3 million under paragraph 5C, of the McLaughlin Agreement. We submit that the Court of Appeals was correct in finding that the evidence was both factually and legally sufficient to show tortious interference by virtue of the defendants engaging in the PNC transaction, by which they did several very important things. They, first of all, non-assumed the option which burdened the business being sold, the GSD. They also instructed the termination of that option. They also contracted amongst themselves that they would have no liability for these actions.
But the termination is different from breach.
Of course, tortious interference doesn't require an absolute breach. We submit that there was an absolute breach here. I think that's what the court would feel.
But they didn't instruct, ACS didn't instruct the bank to walk its obligation to McLaughlin. They just said, get rid of it somewhere.
I disagree, Your Honor, but for this reason. I think if you examine paragraph 7.1 and you examine the McLaughlin Agreement, let's begin first with paragraph 3 of the McLaughlin Agreement granted McLaughlin unambiguously an option to purchase 49%, not 100%, 49% in 91. Option law states that that's an irrevocable offer that must be held open for the period stated. It burdened the asset. It could have been severed. First Texas could have, if it wanted to sell 100% of the business unburdened by that option, could have purchased it. The parties contracted for that opportunity, but they didn't. What ACS and the other defendants got First Texas to do was to sell it with the non-assumption. They specifically say in 7.1 that both ACS and ACST, which is ACSFS, non-assumed the option.
And your argument is that First Texas did not have the contractual right to do that.
First Texas did not have the contractual right to convey the asset to a third party behind McLaughlin's back without compensating him?
Well, in front of his face or behind his back, is it your argument that First Texas could not have transferred the asset without also transferring the obligation to reflecting the option?
But it might depend on the type of transaction. And I know this court held in Tenneco it faced a right of first refusal. And there's a triggering aspect that's not involved in our case. This was an option. The option was granted in 86. It was a full and complete contract at that time. It didn't require anything to trigger. Now, had there been a stock sale, let's assume in Tenneco that the seller and buyer agree that the buyer will not honor the right of first refusal. Would the result have been different? Would there have been a tortious interference scenario? Because that's what happened here. We have parties transferring assets that belong to First Texas to ACS and to Transfers. And they know it's burdened by the option. And they agree among themselves that as between them, they're not going to allow that option to continue. And they know that there's a mechanism between First Texas and McLaughlin to discharge that obligation. Paragraph 5C. And interestingly...
So the transfer was not in violation of the McLaughlin agreement.
Oh, it clearly was in violation of the McLaughlin agreement.
Well, how could it be if there was a mechanism to discharge it without having a transfer?
Because it was non-assumed, and it was immediately repudiated. McLaughlin was left with nothing. He had an institution that no longer had the asset or the ability to control the entity that did acquire it, and as between them, they negotiated that and agreed that it would be terminated.
But if First Texas were solvent, then McLaughlin could come in and say, you never should have transferred this. Give me my 49% or give me my money.
Admittedly,
and First Texas would have to do it.
Admittedly, in any tortious interference case, the right to sue the party that broke the contract exists. That's not the function of the tort service, obviously. It is aimed at redressing the violation of the duty not to interfere. And in the last argument, I know there was some questioning about the result in Clements. And I think the focus is the tort focuses on the third party and the wrong that they are creating. Now, I think in the first case in Texas that recognized the tort, it answers that question. It says the mere fact that the contract obligee has a cause of action against the contract obligor is no answer that justifies the conduct of the interfering party. And let's examine what happened here. If you look at 7.1, look at Schedule 10.10 to their agreement. They admitted that their deal and their language, quote, violated and conflicted with the McLaughlin agreement. They contracted for the non-assumption of the option.
But if First Texas hadn't gone into liquidation, then the ACS would not have induced a breach of the contract.
They induced the breach of the contract in 1988, 5 months before the liquidation, 10 months before the repudiation. This court held in Sterner that until terminated, contract rights are not subject to interference. This contract right was enforceable in July of 1986.
But why is it interference to say, go buy your piece?
It's not.
So they said, ACS said First Texas, go buy your piece.
No, I respectfully disagree. What they said is, sell us that asset. We know it's burdened by an obligation that McLaughlin owns, and we know he has no rights, but we're going to get it, and we agree amongst ourselves it's non-assumed. The practical, effective result of that was that McLaughlin's contract rights were interfered with. And Justice Owen asked earlier about a breach of a contract. Tortious interference does not require that there be an absolute breach of a contract. It involves all interferences with rights of contracting parties. Here we submit there was a breach. I think the evidence demonstrates that McLaughlin's option to purchase in 91 was gone. And the fact that the institution went under means that it did not have the asset to convey to its receiver to then convey to the survivor entity, First Gibraltar.
Let me ask you a minute. You started to say, you said if there had been a stock sale, 100% of the stock, would that stock sale have been burdened with the option?
The option burdened the business.
Under 10B, if they'd sold 100% of the stock of ACS, I think I heard you say that the option would have ceased to exist at that point.
No, I did not mean to suggest that. The option was there. It was not going to go away. The McLaughlin Agreement explicitly says there's only one way for the option to go away. That's to purchase it for $3 million. Now,
10B says you can sell the company.
I disagree, Your Honor. 10B unambiguously says these things. If First Texas gets an offer that it desires to accept, it has to give notice to McLaughlin, who has a right to bid, which First Texas does not have to accept. That's all it says.
And if that had happened, and First Texas said, no, I'm not going to accept your bid, I'm taking the third party, then the option would cease to exist.
No, Your Honor. And there's no mechanism for that result. How could that be? First of all, 10B does not unambiguously state anything about the effect of the
what's
option.
What's the mechanism for valuing the option once the company is sold, which clearly 10B says First Texas has the right
to. Paragraph 5C.
How does that work? Explain to me the mechanics. Let's say First Texas exercised its rights and the 10B legitimately sold the whole kit and caboodle. Then how do you, several years later, value that option right within the confines of the agreement? What's the mechanism?
Well, first let me disagree with the hypothesis that 10B permits a 100% free and clear sale. I don't think it does. But then I think the question is, later on, how would the option be valued?
Assuming that the option
carried through.
How does the purchaser of those assets, is it the First Texas's obligation?
It's an obligation to sell. The option is on the side of the owner of the business to sell McLaughlin in 91 for $100,000.
Let me make sure this is clear. You're saying that if there had been an entire sale of the assets in accordance with 10B, or the stock in accordance with 10B, then your client could have come in and demanded from the purchaser that they convey 49% of that for $100,000.
That's what the McLaughlin agreement provides. And 10B does not allow a sale 100% free and clear. Remember, there's a 51% component here that is free and clear. And that's what 10B deals with. If not, it simply is a mechanism to allow First Texas some flexibility if it doesn't want to remain in the business. But there's no mechanism for the option to vanish. There's no reason. The flexibility afforded First Texas under 10B should devour the option, which is the consideration for the McLaughlin Agreement that appears much earlier in paragraph 3 of the McLaughlin Agreement. And remember the practical effect of this. We mentioned this in our brief. In 1986, this is an unknown business. McLaughlin developed this concept of applying credit cards to distribute various government benefits, to eliminate waste, fraud, etc. It's nationwide virtually now. The consideration given McLaughlin when he conveyed that business to First Texas was the option. 5 years, McLaughlin, if you can make this thing work, you can purchase almost half of it for $100,000. That's in paragraph 3. The next to the last paragraph in the document is 10B. And I submit, if you read, and I know you have, 10B does not mention the option. It does not describe the effect of the option. This court in Sinclair versus Albritton, it's mentioned in the CA opinion. We did not cite it. But it considered an option contract that also had a right of first refusal with it. Now, this is not the same. 10B is not a right of first refusal. We submit that significant because a right of first refusal would provide a mechanism for waiver. It would be an election that would be made. Nevertheless, in Sinclair, the court was grappling with the construction of a contract that, on one hand, gave an option early in the agreement and later gave a right of first refusal. And the court said that the right of first refusal appearing later in the contract was not to be given precedence over the option. And in fact, it said it was not even to be accorded the same dignity of the option. And we cited cases in the brief that say options are to be construed in favor of the buyer. And I think what Your Honor, the scenario that you're painting results in a forfeiture. And forfeitures, if the parties have agreed to them, if they're not unreasonable, would be permissible. McLaughlin and Lazarus did not bargain for a forfeiture. And this gets back to the practical effect.
Counsel, let me ask you, given that First Texas became insolvent and was taken over by the FSLIC and the agreement was repudiated, explain to me how you can show that the actions of the defendants in this case were the proximate cause of damages?
Well, to begin with, understand that what Fislick did was in actuality a nullity. When the institution was put into receivership in December of 88, the PMC transaction had occurred 5 short months before that. That's when all these valuable assets were removed from the institution. Now, the option is a right of McLaughlin to purchase an asset that no longer exists in the institution. The receiver did not get the GSD. Therefore, its repudiation was a nullity. It was telling McLaughlin he couldn't buy something from them that they did not have to convey. And the reason they didn't have it was because it had been interfered with 10 months before in July of 1988. And that's why Sterner and Juliet Fowler are important. Juliet Fowler describes 3 types of contracts: unenforceable, void, and terminable.
But this is an odd thing, because if First Texas had said, look, we're tired of this business, we're not making any money at it, we need to go back to bank, and we're either going to quit or sell it. And the only people we can sell it to don't want this option burden. So if you want to ever realize any money out of this thing,
you, McLaughlin?
Yes. You need to agree to this, because we're going to sell to these folks. If they make $1 billion like they say they're going to, then your formula on the buyout is going to be real high. If they don't, they're not going to do any worse than we're going to do, which is quit.
Well, sometimes contracts produce better results. And I don't know if that's the picture you're painting, but this is simply a better result for First Texas.
No, my question is, how's that interference?
Well, the interference...
It's something that the parties not only might contemplate, they all might want it to happen.
Well, let's look at the McLaughlin Agreement. And remember, this is, first of all, we submit a justification defense, and one that has not been preserved. But let's look at the McLaughlin Agreement. Let's see what they're saying about that. This court can reach that result if 10B unambiguously says the option is over in that event. It does not do that, which creates an ambiguous result. And Your Honors, that ambiguity was tried. McLaughlin was asked, was cross-examined about the purpose of 10B in this case. First Texas conceded in Schedule 1010 he should have gotten notice. And the defendants lost that issue both with respect to the justification answer and the waiver answer. And we submit the evidence is sufficient to support both of those answers. That's what we're talking about here. We're scratching our heads over, we got this McLaughlin Agreement, and here early in the agreement, a very important consideration is conveyed to McLaughlin. This option. And read paragraph 3. The parties knew how to condition their rights. Paragraph 3's grant of the option was conditioned on one paragraph only. Paragraph 5, the buyout. It was not conditioned on paragraph 10. The parties knew what they were doing, but nevertheless, this court is left with the dilemma I think Justice Heck is referring to. That dilemma must be answered as a matter of law, or else it's a fact issue that was tried. It's covered by the justification defense. The issue is, did ACS and the other parties have a legal right under Texas B to purchase this business free and clear of the option? That must be answered by their briefing under 10B. If 10B unambiguously says the option's gone, we lose.
Does the McLaughlin option contain an absolute right for 49% of the assets, or does the First Texas have an option to either pay for that amount or...
It's a double option, Your Honor, which is typical. People are familiar with those in stock transactions, puts and calls. This was a double option. McLaughlin had an option to purchase 49% of the GSD. Now, the parties didn't know what it was going to, how, what
right.
form it was
right.
going to take. And interestingly, 5E says, First Texas, if you want to, you can incorporate it. In that event, McLaughlin would have 49%.
Right, but getting back to the question, if it had been 1991 and they were McLaughlin was exercising its option, did it have an absolute right for specific performance of 49%?
Yes, ma'am.
It did?
Yes, ma'am. Paragraph 3 gives McLaughlin the right to reacquire 49% of the business.
And in that situation, First Texas could not say, instead of 49%, we'll pay you according to the form.
Well, that's correct. They must convey, subject to their obligation to repurchase. But remember, and this brings up, well, what if they're insolvent? Well, the parties bargained for that. First Texas had then the double option to buy it back. But if they're under, if they're insolvent, if they can't, or if they choose not to, and that's okay with McLaughlin, then McLaughlin has its 49%. By that time, it's incorporated, and it's 49% stock ownership.
Paragraph we talked about, the AMS division, wasn't that division sold through Gibraltar to ACS?
Well, that's the abrogation of the option. That's the GSD, the government services business. And I disagree with counsel. It was no insignificant part. It was a $15 million component of a $75 million transaction. It was conveyed to ACS.
The AMS division was conveyed.
The AMS division was conveyed. It's a complex situation. And briefly, let me just indicate what happened. The AMS division became First Texas Government Services business. It was housed in the Moneymaker division of First Texas. ACS under the PNC acquired corporations of First Texas. And then the Moneymaker assets were sold once to those corporations after they were ACS corporations. I don't know if that answers your question, but the business was sold on the basis of the non-assumption of the option that burdened it.
Is it your position that ACS couldn't make that deal? As a freely negotiating third party, they could say, well, we'll buy this, but we don't want to assume this deal, so you have to sell it free and clear to us, and you worry about dealing with the McLaughlin.
They cannot do that. They interfere by doing that, and they create a situation by which, knowing of the option, they become responsible as the acquirer.
But First Texas maintained 51% of shares of the ASC, even through this deal. They still had
50.1.
They still had some interest in ASC.
They had an interest. And this gets into the subsidiary issue. The question is whether or not they were in a position to do anything about McLaughlin's option. The 50.1 is a true red herring because First Texas had no control. Control is the essence of subsidiary. The charts in the briefs of ACS put the GSD under ACS and ACS under First Texas. That's a mischaracterization because there was no control. And as the Supreme Court has held in the Copperwell v. Tubelight, control is the issue there, and that did not exist.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
If it pleases the Court, I think it is clear that the plaintiff's position is that under the McLaughlin agreement, it was impossible to sell the company without the option that might have burdened it. The contract doesn't say that. It is less than a 10-page document. It is several places. In fact, it's precisely in paragraph 10 provides that it can be sold, that the company can be sold, and says what happens if it can. Additionally, it doesn't just say 51% could be sold, because one of the remedies that the plaintiffs would have in the event of a sale is to come in and not buy 51%, but buy 100% of the company. If the court were to decide in the plaintiff's favor on this issue, you would have to rewrite the contract in a way that would be impermissible under Tenneco. His second argument basically is that an option, there is a common law of options that says any option must go with the obligation. I can't find that law, and this court would, I think, be the first one that adopted that as a common law principle. We've researched that, and we cannot find that. Justice Spector asked a question that I think is important, and that basically was this a cash-only purchase right, or was it stock? And the here's what the contract says. Contract 3 says they have the right to buy back 49% of the stock for $100,000 and must, and it uses the term must in 4A, resell it one day later. And then there is a formula that is the subject of how you would define how much they got for that. Maximum of $3 million with the formula cutting it down. Interestingly, there was evidence at the trial court, and I will tell you, it was in controversy to some extent in attack, but there was certainly evidence at the trial court that the value of that option in 1991 was zero. And in fact, the parties anticipated that the value could be zero. It was negative, in fact, and in fact, you'd have to have revenues of $9.1 million more than revenues that they had had, and they only had 6-point-some-odd million percent revenues. This business didn't work, and that's one of the issues that is here as well. Again, the basic position is that you couldn't sell and that ACS couldn't take this on. Now, one of the things he says I think that is fascinating is justification. And he is right. We are not claiming this is justification. Now, that was an issue that was tried, but we're saying this is not interference. We have not complained of the justification finding of the trial court, and he's absolutely right about that. But he mischaracterizes justification. A second ago, he said, justification is the legal right of First Texas, the obligor, to do a certain act. That is not the focus of justification. Justification is the legal right of the third-party defendant who is allegedly interfering with the contract. That's all that is. We are not saying that ACS necessarily had a right to do this. We are saying that First Texas, the obligor, had the right to sell this property, and as a result, if it did so, ACS, as a matter of law, could not have interfered with the contract. If you accept the plaintiff's theory, once again, and they have two, one that you could, that you had to sell the option right with the company. No law that does it. The contract does not say that. You'd have to write that conclusion in. And the second thing they say is you could only sell 49% of this company. Or I may have that different. I think he says 51.1%. You couldn't sell the other 49%. The contract prohibited. Nothing in the contract says that. And in fact, in the option, the early buyout option that is referenced in case there is a sale, it is clear that if they receive notice and bid, they were bidding not on 50.1%, they were bidding on 100%. Why? That's why. That is because the person who would buy, in this case ACS, was buying 100%.
Any other questions? Mr. Keltner, did you say that ACS had a right to do what it did even if it breached the contract?
No, sir. I'm sorry.
Maybe I misunderstood.
No, Your Honor, I'm sorry. Two elements. If I said that, I certainly didn't mean to. But sometimes I say strange things. First is, you have to induce the breach of the contract. The second is, ACS had the right to induce the obligor under the contract, First Texas, to do anything First Texas had the right to do under the contract. That's what Julius Fowler Holmes says specifically, this court decision of 1990, and that was my point.
Thank you, counsel. I conclude the argument in the third cause, and the court will take another recess.
All rise.